I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is DeRay. Welcome to Posse of the People. In this episode, it's me, Kai, and Miles talking about the news that you don't know with regard to race, justice, and equity. We talk about everything from the student protest to the TikTok ban to some stuff with the police and judiciary. Here we go. You know, we love to support the non-binary community, and you know we also love wordplay. So, of course, we have a new tee in the Cricut store that does both. They, them's the rules. Pick up the shirt now by heading to cricut.com/store.
Welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. Family, we're so happy to be back with you. I'm Kaya Henderson. You can find me on Twitter at HendersonKaya.
I'm Malzy Johnson. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter and TikTok for now at Feral Rapture.
And it's Dray at D-R-A-Y on Twitter.
Well, family, a lot has been going on this week. We have, I think the most interesting and important thing happening is the protests on college campuses across the country. Of course, kicked off by Columbia University, but now continuing at universities all over the country, and wanted to get your take on what's happening right now. Miles E. Johnson, you look like you have some significant thoughts on this topic. So kick us off with the conversation.
Ooh, the pressure. I don't know how significant they are, but they are my thoughts. I'm really proud. Since I've seen a lot of political movements, specifically the ones that get media coverage happen, I think that I've seen so many young people and not so young people now get kind of absorbed into the media circus of it all. And I'm really appreciative of the focus of this. I'm really appreciative of the fact that you get young people who care about global humanity. I think so often, specifically in America, we kind of only care about what's happening in our front door, or that's the stereotype, is that we only care about what happens in our front door. And this does remind me of Vietnam. This does remind me of just moments where young American folks and just American folks in general have cared about something that is not just necessarily happening on their doorstep. And that gives me a lot of hope and excitement. I hope other people take these divestments seriously too. I think when it comes to like the Starbucks stuff, I think we started seeing that last year when it came to Starbucks and other corporations like McDonald's that people were openly divesting from. I think, you know, part of organizing, if you're not going to be on the front lines, is also aligning with what those organizers are asking for, too. So I hope a lot of people take seriously these things. And Mark Lamont Hill posting that he gave back his endowment and didn't show up to a speech in order to show solidarity. I think those type of moves are just as important as the people who are on the front lines in times like this, to show them that we ain't playing with them. We ain't playing. We are willing to put a bag down, to put our fist up.
I think it's so fascinating to me that, you know, in a learning community of all places is where you think that this would be a moment where the university figures out how to work with students and help students process. And we figure out the, you know, negotiation, knowing that sometimes we won't always agree, but the tension is a part of the work. Like, that is what you'd expect in a learning community. And instead, they just call the police. And you're like, well, that's right. Sort of wild. I think it also is a reminder at how easily the police become mobilized. I am fascinated by the idea that because we disagree, it is a crime. That is essentially what the universities have said. Like, because I like that you don't like what I did, I'm calling the police on you. And shame on all of the cities that allowed it to happen. Shame on the mayor of Boston, the mayor of New York City, the mayor of LA, who let the police go onto those campuses. Because just because we at Black communities know this all the time, just because you call the police don't mean they're coming. And in this case, not only did the police come, but they came with rifles in groups of 100. In St. Louis, WashU, the way those officers grabbed those kids with the city council president on campus, with another council member on campus, was just stunning. And this morning, I don't know if you saw it, but the president of Columbia released a statement saying that negotiations have broken down. She also said that the school will not divest from Israel. And said, quote, "The encampment has created an unwelcoming environment for many of our Jewish students and faculty." And what I find so wild about all of this is the chants that are like, go back to Gaza and all that. Nobody's talking about that. It seems to be only a subset of students who people seem to care about in this moment, which is really wild. And it's not lost on me that all of this is about a war in another country. That like, y'all are willing to lock up all of your students because you are protecting an investment in decimating another country. I mean, that is just stunning to me. So, you know, many of these college leaders have failed, in my view, and I hope that there's a long repercussion for their careers. And I even think, you know, this is when I miss being a street organizer in this way. I want the kids at Columbia to do like a no-talk protest to the president. Like, any room she enters, they leave. Anytime she talks, they turn their back. Anytime she greets somebody, people just literally refuse to engage her as their leader because she just cannot lead.
That's powerful. I'm watching this, and like you, Miles, I thought a lot about the Vietnam War protests and just how students are always sort of on the cutting edge of big social change. In most large social movements that we've seen around the world, students are the bellwether. And I think that, and so I'm excited that students are mobilizing. I'm excited that this group of students are mobilizing in this particular time. I think these are kids who have, you know, weathered the pandemic, who have had, you know, they have not had a regular sort of childhood and upbringing, and yet and still they find purpose and community in justice, right? And so I'm always heartened by young people. They are my hope. And I feel, you know, I feel concern for Jewish young people who don't feel safe on their campuses. And like you, DeRay, I actually think that the use of force, the use of police force is absolutely like out of bounds. I'm actually excited by the organizing that the young people are doing. Like, they are using social media, they're getting on Zoom calls, like they are strategic and thoughtful. And it just, I don't know, I think that in a time of deep polarization, it shows that we can still come together around causes that are really important to us. And so I'm just watching, right? I don't have much of an opinion about it. I'm watching because I think that this is the opening of a much larger conversation. This isn't just about Israel and Palestine. This is also about a failed university system. This is about a failed social system that doesn't listen to its constituents and isn't doing the will of the people, the bidding of the people. And so I'm excited. I think that this is, especially leading up to this election, I think people are going to be forced to ask hard questions. I think our very conception of leadership, as you noted, DeRay, is completely challenged right now. And I'm interested in what new things brings forth from this.
I had a little question.
Yeah.
I haven't been watching everything 24/7, so this is a genuine question. Has there been any type of publicity around or any reporting on like the young Jewish students like being harmed in any type of way? Like, is that a thing?
You know, the one that went, did you see the one that went viral that was like, somebody was like, they got hit in the head with the flag? Miles,
I didn't see it. No, that's, no.
There was this like viral attack, like that, when the Jewish protesters got attacked. And then when you watch the video, literally, it's like a kid walking down the path or whatever with a flag. The kid like turns around, like the kid's like just walking, and the flag like mistakenly just like taps the person, like grazes him. But like, it's because the person's like turning. If you didn't see that video, thank God somebody caught on video. If you didn't see the video, you would think that somebody stabbed this person in the eye. And it's like, y'all, come on. Like, this is just not in good faith. In some of the memes, I don't know if you saw one of the memes that has been going around, posted by like, reposted by influential members of the tech community, is like, you know, it's something like, we thought Hamas was only overseas, but it's now on university campuses. And it's like, that is just gross.
Yeah.
There were Jewish students at Cooper Union who were locked in the school's library as pro-Palestinian demonstrators pounded on doors and shouted slogans. There are instances. I think we haven't, I don't know, I haven't personally seen a ton of coverage, but it seems that there are issues, that there are documented cases of things happening to Jewish students.
I do want all students to be safe, all people to be, like, all people to be safe. And I think that is a part of the good side of American culture, is the idea that we can all protest and get things done, and also respect other people's beliefs and identities. Also, I'm just very weary, which is one of the reasons why I've been stepping back from social media, specifically during times like this, because I do know that this is a time that stories get manipulated, things that, you know, and it's not just Auntie Kaya, as far as like something happened in October getting resurfaced. Like, that's happened so often, even in celebrity culture. Somebody will go through something and you'll be like, okay, oh, they just did this. And you're like, oh, you did all this 1 week. You're like, oh no, that's what they've been reported to do in the last 10 years. And we're just talking about it all in one day. So I do also want people who are still very engaged in social media to be super critical during these times, because not everything that you're seeing is just to inform you. A lot of things are, you're being seen to shape you and to seduce you into certain ways of thinking. And there does seem to be an investment in being anti-Palestinian, anti-ceasefire right now. And I think that like little stories and manipulations can really assist in people creating narratives, specifically people who aren't, I hate using media literate because it sounds insulting to say somebody's media illiterate, but people are not as media savvy and knowing how social media works, you know? That's the only two cents I want to give.
I think that's right. And I also think from an empathy perspective that it probably is not particularly, I could understand why if you are a Jewish student who does not agree with the pro-Palestinian stance, because I don't want to also paint the picture that all Jewish students are opposed to, because that is not the case.
Absolutely.
But if you are a Jewish student who is opposed to the pro-Palestinian stance, I could understand why this would be a rough time for you on campus and you might not want to come back. So I think both of those things are true. But I think your point is well said.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
In other news this week, Amanda Seales, y'all, I found out this week that Amanda Seales is my birthday twin. Oh my soul. We are born on the same day, July 1st. And oh, cousin Amanda, she was on Club Shay Shay and did a whole almost 3-hour interview. Where I think she was seeking to get her side of the story out in this ongoing conversation about, you know, where she sits in Black culture. And I'm not a fan. I'm not a fan. I've been trying. I really have been trying. I was particularly unconvinced by her explanation of her behavior through her recent autism spectrum diagnosis. I did not think that that was the appropriate explanation for how she has behaved. I felt like she was super combative in the Club Shay Shay interview and literally was accusing, like Shannon Sharpe, and I'm not a Shannon Sharpe fan by any means, but I felt like he was trying to say to her, some of this stuff is not racism. Maybe, like, as a child, you know, challenging an adult, which was a situation that she brought up, maybe that was the problem. And she was like, you weren't there. You're discounting my lived experience. You're undermining me. And I just felt like, I don't even know, y'all. I can't, I'm not a fan. I don't, I'm done. I can't with it. I just cannot. What I can hold space for. Amanda Seales is reaching people with a particular message that is really important. She just ain't my cup of tea. Sorry. I'm done.
Yeah, I think we probably sit on the exact opposite.
That's fine. Spectrum. Mm-hmm. I'm not surprised by that.
I'm not trying. I'm like Auntie Kaya, let's hold hands. So personally, I have an affection for Amanda Seales. Very early in my like hip hop, black pop culture exploration, and back in middle school, she had things she was doing with this company called Karma Loop, and I got into her during that like era. And then she was going by Amanda Diva at the time. She was doing poetry and stuff like that. So I have my own like personal affection for her, of course, too. But then also what was interesting too, seeing her and Shannon Sharpe speak to each other, was that, I'm actually seeing actively a generational thing happen. And it's weird because she's not the youngest, you know, chick, you know. So, but it was interesting to see that I think that she, as she's getting older, she's adopted more expansive ways of thinking about gender. She's talked about those things. She's obviously adopted some more radical politics, or developed those radical politics, rather. And then even when it comes to an autism diagnosis, like, that's something that happened to me, like, 3 or 4 years ago as I got my autism diagnosis. And that, to me, feels like a generational marker as well, whereas, like, my mom was like, if I'm not doing ABC ableist things, or if I don't have an intellectual disability or something that's not making me be able to retain information, then it's made up. So I think that there was a way that she was talking and being challenged that I felt like she was really standing up for a generational divide in the black community. And then Shannon Sharpe was saying, oh no, like, this teacher could just be, you were challenging authority, or are you sure the kids were racist? Maybe they're just repeating what they were saying, or are you sure you have autism or whatever? Because, you know, don't just be labeling yourself stuff and stuff like that. It was kind of these things that, sure, Shannon Sharpe was saying it, but I really think that he was being a mouthpiece for a lot of people's generational beliefs, as what I think Amanda Seales was, which is also, I think that this conversation is striking such a chord. I don't really think it has a lot to do with the personalities all the time that's happening, but what those personalities are representing and the conflict and what the conflict is representing. But I don't know. I really love Amanda Seales, and I really do think that we are in times that have lots of color. We are in times that are sometimes beautiful, oftentimes ugly. And I think that if we can only take sweet, honey, pretty voices during these times, we are restricting how far we can go and what we can think. And I think that I like that she's in these spaces, not occupying this hyper respectable, hyper professional space that a black woman usually has to be in order to be in the news and culture space. She speaks how she speaks. She talks like MC Light in 91. She curses.
I sure don't have no problem with MC Light in 91 or cursing or any of that, right?
But I think there's a combative.
Mm-hmm. I think that you are giving her a lot more than I think that that is the, I can't even call that reading generous. I'm happy that you started with I like Amanda Seales, because that is what I think. I think that, and she had a great interview on this podcast, and I'm only commenting because I do think a part of living your life in public means that when you put it in, like, we have public conversations about people who do things in public. Like, I think that is, you know, I think it was fascinating. I'll just talk about the autism thing because I thought that was a fascinating exchange, because later she comes out and says she was not medically diagnosed with autism. She diagnosed herself, and that she couldn't afford a diagnosis. And everybody's like, well, Amanda, you're not, you know, you have more resources than most. It doesn't cost as much as da da da. And then she, you know, she's posted another video where she's like, you know, people are being critical of me. And it's like, well, no, Amanda, I think the way you said it on the interview made it seem like you were medically, that was a fair reading.
Yes, absolutely.
People were not reading into that. And then for you to come around and be like, oh no, that was deflection. Nobody has the right to, it's like, you know, I think that what is a through line for Amanda is I don't know one moment where she's been challenged in public where she takes actual accountability, where she says, you know what, I did that. I sort of messed that up. Could have done this a little better. And he is, the autism thing is fat. It's like, instead of being like, you know, maybe I misspoke and I could have been clear, she's like doubling down on y'all just didn't get it. And it's like, no, I think people got it. And I do think that she finds a sense of power in being the person that people don't like. I think that is true. And that's fine. Like that is like a cool space if you want to own it, but I don't.
But then you can't whine about it when people don't like you. That's the thing. My thing is, Miles, I'm down for the direct. I'm down for the ugly. I'm down for the challenging. I'm whatever, right? Like, I'm good for that all. We need those voices and those spaces. But then you can't be like, how come nobody likes me? You can't tell me my house is dirty and then be like, why don't you invite me to dinner at your house? Like, and for me, everything is the accountability piece to write. Everything is somebody else's problem. Sis, you done got fired from
somebody
every,
else's fault.
Yes, you done got fired
it's
from everything in the world, but it's all like the whole entire world is conspiring against you. Come on, I just can't. And if that's generational, I'm down with it. I'm Gen X and that's what it is. But at some point, personal responsibility has got to be part of the conversation.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I hear y'all. I really do. I also think that I think the water that she's swimming in is like toxic and poisonous. So I think it's hard for me to say, I mean, it's this weird situation for me talking about her because I put my affection for her aside. Also, I just think that media and the landscape of media has gotten, like, shallower. So, like, any comparisons I can draw just are not, just feel silly because I don't want to compare her to, like, civil rights heroes or whatever. But I think there's just, like, anything like that. But I'm like, I just don't know when it became hard to fathom that a Black person with radical and or certain types of leanings would have a hard time in corporate America. I was not a child star. So you put My Little Black Tail and Nickelodeon and then HBO and all these other things, I'm like, yeah, I will be able to tell you things that have been wrong. Even in my career trajectory that I have had, if you took me to, when you take me from Afropunk to The Fader, if you take me to all these different places I've had, I have horror stories about all these different things. And I don't think that those are just because I was a fault-projecting person. I think, oh no, the water I was swimming in was poisonous and I was not able to be assimilated or neutered correctly, so I didn't have a positive time. And it doesn't seem unfathomable that somebody else would have a mirroring time, specifically somebody who might be a part of a younger generation or the beginning of a younger generation that's like, oh, I do not want to do that. Actually, I did not swallow the Huxtable pill like that, and I don't want to give up that part of my soul or my mind or my politic in order to have a house or to go further. So I think that that's a thing too to me. Like, I could see that.
The only thing I'd say though, Miles, is that she does want it. That's the thing though that I think is like fascinating. She wants to be interviewed by Essence. She wants to be at the party. She is not rejecting those things. And the only reason we know about it is because she keeps talking about it. It's not like nobody's like sleuthing. So I think that reading you just gave, I would totally agree. If she was like, that's not who I am. That's not what I want. And people keep putting that on me. I'm trying to do this sort of work. But she's like, no. These people won't invite me to the party. Essence won't interview me. They won't let me da da da.
But wasn't she invited to the party? I think that was the thing. I mean, I'm just asking a question. Like, She said that she was invited by three different people to that party. She said that she did do something with Essence. She said she did host a BET award. So these aren't things that she's trying to get invited to. These are things that she was invited to, was folded into, then disposed of.
I'll just talk about Essence specifically, but it wasn't like she was... We don't know why the... You've been interviewed for a million things that got canceled last minute, right? Like, where... And it would be an unfair reading to be like, every time somebody canceled on you is because they hated you.
But she literally said that the reason why the editor-in-chief, or excuse me, that the CEO canceled, she said that the person, her assistant, told her the reason why it was canceled was because they were afraid of it being live streamed and they didn't want to do a gotcha interview with Amanda, and that's why she canceled. So she said why everything was canceled. I mean, if she could be lying. I'm not saying that she's not lying. She could be totally lying and she could be full of shit. But I'm saying, to me, I'm like, oh, that sounds about right. I've been in situations where people have been like, I don't want to talk about this left thing that you got to talk about. So either it needs to be recorded and I can approve it, or it's not happening.
I'm just saying there are a million things that I don't participate in because I don't want to, even though I'm invited. Just because I, like, don't want to be there anymore. I'm like, not my cup of tea. Interesting. Like, I've been to the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I got invited to parties this year around the White House Correspondents' Dinner. I can't in good faith go to that while the kids are in the middle of the street. That doesn't make sense to me. Do you know what I mean? So I think my dissonance with her is that she continues to be frustrated by not being invited into these traditional Hollywood spaces and da-da-da, while also... sort of saying they don't matter. And it's like, yeah. And it's like, well, one, that can't. And now I'm like, I get why you aren't. You know, if this is how it happens, I get why.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
So my news is definitely TikTok. I'm really fascinated by it. So I kind of feel like TikTok is one of those things, or I should say social media is one of those things where I never expected to feel like this, but I kind of feel like, where were you when something happened? So I say what to say is, this is the first time that I'm experiencing something that feels nostalgic happening to social media. This reminds me of Vine. And I'm like, oh, I've seen this show before. Like, I've seen this political and cultural moment happen before. And now I'm feeling nostalgic because a whole other generation is experiencing it. I'm like, oh yeah. Corporations and/or the government will take your favorite platform, and you will have to start from scratch. I think I wanted to bring this as news because I wanted to see what everybody was thinking about it, because I do think that TikTok is something that, like, is affecting a specific demographic of people in creators in America. But I do also think that if Biden is looking to, like, and maybe he's not, maybe that's the thing too, but like, maybe like, if Biden's looking to, like, motivate people who are young to get to the polls, taking away one of the more popular social media platforms is just not the way to do it. And I guess also I just wanted to know, like, what are y'all's thoughts on where this is heading? Like, do you think it's going to be sold? Is that like the idea that within this, like, time allotted for them to sell and do business, it's going to happen? Or do you think this is going to vanish like a vine? Or do you think that's, like, not an option? Again, I think that it's going to be interesting between... Not trying to equate these things, but when it comes to what's happening in Palestine and in these protests, and then what's happening with TikTok, it just feels like there's a lot of stuff happening to, like, really make young people not really motivated for Biden. And in my imagination, the opposite would be the goal right now, because we're in an election year, and it feels like maybe in their head they were like, well, them young kids is not going to get with us, so let's just... Go over here, because this is where we have more stakes and we have more power, so just forget it. So I'm like, is that what's happening? Because this couldn't be saved until... politics is dirty, right? This couldn't be saved to 2025.
Next year, after the election.
You could have got in. Like, I'm like, what was the rush? But also, maybe you're trying to galvanize another group of people to think that you're hard on foreign politics or something like that. Maybe that was the goal. I don't know. So yeah, this was a news that I'm bringing more so for my selfish reasons to get some clarity that is not around this, that from people who are smarter in the area of electoral politics than I am, because I'm a little confused by this move.
Yeah, I find this to be so interesting because are we really, you know, Miles, to your, the narrative that people want us to believe, like, are we really afraid of the Chinese government having information about all of the people dancing and planting and recipeing and whatever on TikTok? Or are we trying, or is this another sort of move in the cultural wars to suppress information to, you know, I mean, we got book bans, we got, you know, police on protesters, like this squelching of the free flow of information, I think is incredibly dangerous. It's really dangerous. And I mean, I think, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, TikTok won't go away before the election. Heck, Mr. Biden has a TikTok account for the Biden campaign has a TikTok account, right? Because it's trying to appeal to young people. But I think the longer move is, you know, controlling information. The thing about the internet is that it democratized the flow of information. Before, a few people controlled all of the information that we got. And now, you know, we know about what's happening, not from official channels, but from on the ground reporting. I mean, DeRay is DeRay because he was able to bring the Ferguson protest. Not DeRay is DeRay because he's magnificent, but we know DeRay because he was able to bring the Ferguson protests to the people in a way that the regular media was not covering. And I think that this kind of suppression is really, really dangerous. I also think it's just capitalistic and greedy. And I think I think it's not going to go away, right? Somebody is making the next TikTok or replicating TikTok and they want it to be owned by, I mean, look who the Republicans have pulled together. They're like, we got a group, we'll buy the TikTok, right? Like, and so I think that this is both another, you know, shot in the culture wars. And I think it is greedy capitalists who are trying to rejigger the system.
But yeah, I also think that if I was really trying to screw over the American government, I would get rid of TikTok 2 weeks before the election, just like literally just break the app and like force all these people into a tizzy. You know, because like that is, it's such a wild decision to do. I also think that, you know, I do think a lot of politics focuses on voters, and I don't know if the voting majority actually cares about TikTok. So I think there are like a lot of aunts and uncles who vote every year who are like, all they know TikTok as is another version of Reels. And it's not a, like, they don't sort of care. They're not worried about the creator economy crashing. They certainly aren't worried about this being the primary way that people get their news. Like, they still watch MSNBC and CNN. So I do think that if you're playing to voters, I don't know if this is a wild idea. Now, if you are trying to convert voters, I think this is a crazy idea. And if you're trying not to piss off young people, I think you have completely
totally
miscalculated. And I think that the Biden team doesn't get that, like, you know, the Trump people are getting their people in line. All the, like, Trump got those people lined up. They are ready for their contracts they're going to get from the government. They don't like that man, but they don't need to like him because they are trying to get something far greater than being liked by Donald Trump. And I worry that the left does not have the people lined up and student loans are not going to be enough.
Can I share my news next? Because it also is from the, like, what do we think is happening here? What is the point? So my news comes out of Florida, and it is about Governor DeSantis challenging this rule around children's health, the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, which in Florida is called Florida Kid Care. And basically what has happened is, over since January 1st, the DeSantis administration has kicked out more than 22,500 children from the Florida Kid Care program. This is a program that's jointly subsidized between state and local government for U.S. families that are just above, earn just above the Medicaid threshold. And there's a law that the federal government put in place to protect families. Families still have to pay premiums. And if you miss a premium, previously, the states could kick you off of the program. But in fact, the federal government created this thing called the Continuous Eligibility Clause, which basically says if you even make one payment in the course of a year, you can continue to be eligible. Well, Mr. DeSantis says that that flies in the face of his state law. And he appealed, he went to court to say this Continuous Eligibility Clause is unfair, which is fine. That's his legal right. But instead of waiting for the verdict, he's just been kicking people off right now. And so, you know, this year, the monthly average of children being disenrolled is 1,500 higher than the whole number of disenrollments in 2023. So long story short, this man is kicking poor people, poor children, off of the insurance program that covers them because they miss a payment. And my question is, like, to what end? What is the point here? What do we think that this is accomplishing? I'm asking for this friend because I literally do not understand what you get from putting children off of, like, taking children off of the insurance that covers them. Poor children.
I think one thing that this story reminds me of, and thank you for bringing it, is that, you know, America has our own genocides that we're doing against poor people, against people who are of color, Black folks. Like, that to me is what this is. And I think that how we do it is always different. And how we do it is often through law or through legal means in order to protect the illusion of civility. But when we really crack it open and see what the goal is the goal is to disappear children and to make sure children aren't here, specifically children who, you know, the state might have to be responsible for, the children that might do things that are against the state. I think that to me is the only way my brain can work when I see things like that, because there's just no other reason why adults in power wouldn't want children to be healthy and to have access to care.
I think of a couple of things. One is, even when I watch the campus encampments, I am in the minority here, but I do think that the far left has gotten it wrong in terms of what the impact is. So I think that people watch this and they're like, crystal clear, this is crazy, people will understand how violent the police are. And I actually think that's not what happens. I think that people are looking at this and they're like, wow, the police really screwed up this one thing. They are not looking at it like the system is flawed and the whole thing is corrupt. And that is not people's takeaway. So that's like one. The second is, I say that because I think that we have a long way to go to help people understand like institutional racism. I think those words, we get it, but I don't think, I always say that aunts and uncles are a better reflection of where the majority is. And I think if any of you call your aunt and uncle and say, what is institutional racism? I think the answer you get will be far from what you think. And I say that because when I think about Florida, we understand this is institutional racism and which I don't think is a political message, an organizing message we've won on our side. I don't think people see that yet. I think people sort of are like, this is the system. You know, it is what it is, But the last thing I'll say is that the right, more than anybody, understands that the numbers are on our side. They get it. They have understood it for a long time, which is why their play has been fix the voting, gerrymander the maps so that the numbers won't matter, and stack the court so when people go try and challenge it, we will win. Because they're sort of like, we might lose the elected thing, but we can make the map our map, and then we can make it impossible to overturn it, right? They get the numbers thing. And I say that because the biggest fear is for people to get up and realize that they have power. And if you keep people trapped in this, like, I don't know what I'm going to eat in the next 10 minutes, it's just really hard for them to organize. And I say that as an organizer. It's like hard to, it's hard to talk to people about the corruptness of the police when they are like, I'm trying to like pay rent. Like, and not like I just need to go to work, but like, I might not be able to pay rent. And you were here talking about this philosophical, you know, like, it's hard when people don't know where their next meal's coming from to talk to them about gerrymandering. It's just a really hard thing to do. And the right gets that. The last thing I'll say too about all of this is that when I think about the campus, when I think about the the situation in Gaza. Last night I was like, we are paying for that, Kaya. It's not, the billionaires are not paying for that. They're not paying taxes. You and me are paying for that. So yes, the idea that we should have a say is actually really important.
That's right.
Because we are paying for all, we are paying for Medicaid. We're paying for Social Security. Like, you and your cousins are. You are. The rich people on Amazon aren't paying any taxes. They really are actually not paying for this. Can we talk about the district attorney, Dorley, in New York State, in Monroe County? So Dorley gets pulled over
She's
20
Monroe
miles above
County.
The speed limit. That officer turned on his body camera, and she literally, we're going to play some of the clip.
Talk to Jeff.
Okay.
I was just on the phone with the chief.
Okay. I'm the supervisor right now, so.
Okay. Sorry. Okay. I didn't want to pull over on Phil Turner. It was just, I figured I'd just pull into my driveway.
Okay. Well,
I called Dennis and I said, okay, that's me that they're trying to stop.
Okay.
So that's the end of story.
Okay. But you should know better, right?
I was speeding. I know that.
Okay, so why didn't you just stop like you're supposed
because
to?
Because I didn't feel like stopping on Phillips Road at 5:30.
That's not your choice. You know that.
Well, I made it my choice.
Okay, well, now you made it a bigger deal than it needed to be.
It's a really bigger deal. And when people start coming, it's a much bigger deal.
Well, you caused that, Sandra. Well, what do you want us to do? Not do our job because it's you?
No, it's fine. I said, write me a ticket. But I was just saying, I was not going to stop at Phillips Road at 5:30.
Okay, well, you broke another law because of that, right? And you should know better. That's not a traffic ticket. That's an arrestable offense, Sandra. You know this. Why would you not just pull over? You made it a bigger deal than it needed to be. And you knew why you were getting stopped, clearly.
Clearly.
He could have stopped you, had a conversation with you, and been done with it. But now you made it this whole big deal. For no reason. Did you provide him your license and registration?
Yeah.
Okay.
She literally is like, I'm the DA. I don't care. I wasn't going to pull over. I wanted to pull over in my garage. What?
I didn't feel like pulling over. And the man said, didn't you see my lights and my sirens? And she said, I thought you were going somewhere else. I wasn't paying attention because I was on the phone. He's like, you're not supposed to be on the phone. She's like, yes, I absolutely can. Hands free. Do you know what I'm dealing with? I'm dealing with 3 murders. I'm dealing with whatever, whatever. I called Dennis and told him the people that they're chasing is me. So what, lady? Like, you are the DA. You are breaking the law. The police are doing their job. And you are like, miss me with this because this I don't care that I was going 20 miles over.
She releases an apology video today, on Monday, where she apologizes to the police officer for her tongue, for being rude. The governor, Governor Hochul, has recommended her, or like push her case over to, there's a prosecutor accountability task force that just got put together a year or so ago. And this will be their most high profile case. Hopefully they at least disbar her, remove her from office. The governor actually has the power to remove her, but it hasn't happened in a gazillion years. But there's no way she can actually be the DA. And this goes without saying that she is a Republican. And she definitely thinks that she's above the law, and the brazenness in the video is just something to behold. But my actual news,
wild.
Dorley
totally
was fascinating.
Wild.
My actual news is about Alameda County. We know the public defender, chief public defender in Alameda County. He is a phenomenal guy, Brendan Woods. But in Alameda County, a federal judge ordered the district attorney to review all death penalty cases handled by their office because there is seeming proof that the prosecutors for a period of time were working to exclude Black people and Jewish people from juries with the idea that if they were on the juries, they would not convict people or go for the death penalty. They found this all started because of a 1993 trial where they found notes that show the prosecutors who handled the case identified Jewish people and Black people and specifically sought to take them from the office. One undated note referred to a potential juror as a short, fat troll. Another, describing a Black woman, says race, no issue, but I don't believe her. And this wasn't just one or two people. This seemed to be a whole collection of prosecutors. The DA's office, because of this court ruling, is reviewing 35 active death penalty cases and will potentially review matters dating all the way back to 1977. They are currently notifying the families of the victims, of people whose death penalty cases are being reviewed, and at least three people convicted in Alameda County. Alameda County is essentially the Bay Area minus San Francisco. So it's Oakland's the biggest thing that you would know. And at least three people convicted in Alameda County have already been resentenced due to the evidence that Black people and Jewish people were removed from the jury. So I bring this up just because, for a couple reasons. One is that, you know, the only way the other side wins is by cheating. I'll maintain that to the end of time. That, like, if we funded the public defenders the way that we fund everybody else, if prosecutors could be disbarred for lying and doing things like Dorley, this whole system, it'd be a different world. But they win because either the rules are stacked on their sides or they lie. Insert the police and this whole other thing. And this is another example that, like, y'all don't even, you're not getting fair juries. You're excluding people in ways you know are racist and unconstitutional. But the second thing, and Brendan has said this, the chief public defender, he's been public defender for a decade, is that if you think that this is only limited to death penalty cases in Alameda County, then you are fooling yourself. They were doing this for a whole, we just don't have the proof yet. But you got to believe this is happening for a whole lot of other cases. So I wanted to bring it here because it blew my mind.
That is my big takeaway for the week, DeRay, right? Like, the other side only wins by cheating. And this, I mean, literally my first thought was only death penalty cases. But it's shocking to see the clarity around, like, no Black women, no Black people, no Jewish people. Like, it is shocking to see the, like, outright racism that, like, permeates our judicial system, permeates. I mean, this is your exact point about my story. Institutional racism. Like, and for all of the people who are like, there is no systemic racism, there is no institutional racism, just listen to our podcast. All we do is lift up these examples of institutions, healthcare institutions, judicial institutions, educational institutions, where racism is baked into how these systems work. And I don't know how you can't. I don't know how you can say that this doesn't exist, but it is, you know, it is the reason why some of us are deathly afraid to do anything wrong, because there's no way you get a fair shake in the judicial system as a person of color. So this was, I mean, it wasn't shocking to me. It is what I believe and what I will extend to the DA's quote is, if you think it's just happening in Alameda County, then you got something wrong with you too, because this is happening all across the country. So yikes.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to By Save the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Cricket Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Cricket Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Futopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.